Taxation Number 12288, Rule 4.
Breathwaite, Rule 4. So you actually saw the slogan on the roof, did you?
Yes, I saw it on there. I also understand that the Indian troops who were to attack were launched by assault craft over a fairly long stretch of shallow water, which was extremely rough, and when they arrived there, most of them were seasick and couldn't have taken part in any fighting anyway. The flying on 159 and 99 Squadron was largely over water, and we had to fly across the Indian Ocean and generally make landfall on the Andaman Islands and then change course from there to wherever we were going. And the problem with flying over water was navigation difficulties, because there were no wireless aids apart from obtaining beacon fixes. And we had to rely on drift readings taken by the rear gunner by throwing out a flare and training his, getting it to run between the guns in his turret and reading off the deflection on the ring of his turret. And that way we could keep track of the drift and keep on track. But there was no way of knowing your ground speed, because that depended on the speed and direction of the wind. And so while we could stay pretty well in the right direction, we never knew quite at what time we were going to arrive anywhere. ETAs were hopelessly out. But we managed it all right. Also, we had to fly below 500 feet all the time to avoid radar interception. And the Liberators were particularly good for that, excuse me, because they had a radio altimeter which wasn't affected by barometric pressure or anything. It simply sent a beam down and it came back and they measured the rebound and that told you precisely what height you were at. And in the monsoon season, when you couldn't see an inch, the windscreen was absolutely covered with driving rain, it was some consolation to have an altimeter like that, which showed every variation in height foot by foot. It was, quite consoling. The weather there was, you daren't fly into cloud, because if you got into a cumulonimbus cloud, the upward currents were so violent that they would break up aircraft. And there are many instances where whole formations of particularly fighters were broken up and just disappeared going into these huge storm clouds. So we were concerned to keep below them, and this altimeter helped to a great extent. We also got quite a lot of electric storms there, and you'd see the electricity, the lightning playing about on the aircraft wings and propellers. Spectacular, but a bit scary. also, a lot of the flying over land was over very heavy vegetation and jungle. And there wasn't much prospect of survival if you were forced to land in that.
Did you have survival kits?
Oh, yes. if you were in trouble and could make it, the ideal thing was to get to the coast, which was never too far away, because Malaya is a long, narrow country, and land on the shore. At least there was a cleared level landing site, and there was a faint hope that you might be picked up by some of the occasional flying boat patrols which went looking for downed crews. We were armed with a variety of guns, actually. Everybody had a revolver and a knife, Some had submachine guns, some had sporting rifles for game, and some had ordinary rifles for in case you met enemy patrols.
You mean they were just privately supplied?
No, the crew were supplied with a variety of weapons which enabled them, gave them the best chance of surviving if they were shot down. We carried maps and compasses in the form of fly buttons or compasses. You'd cut two buttons off and stand one on top of the other and it would point north. Excuse me. And we had the usual hacksaw blades in rubber mountings sewn into various parts of our jackets and that. And one of the things we had, which was quite useful, was a map, which to all intents and purposes was a light brown pocket handkerchief. And if you broke up a cigarette in water and then dipped the map in it, it would remove the colouring and leave the map exposed. We carried money in the local currency and reward notes, offering a reward to anybody who helped any airman who was in trouble. And we carried rations, of course, and a supply of water purification tablets because obviously local water was heavily polluted. But nobody really relished the prospect of going down in the jungle. I think people sort of took it for granted that that was it. If you went down the jungle, there wasn't much hope of survival. Although some did.
What did you imagine would happen to you if you fell into enemy hands?
Well, that was anybody's guess. I mean, if you were lucky and fell into regular army hands, you'd get taken to a prisoner of war camp. But I don't know what actually happened, but everybody understood that if you fell into the hands of casuals or patrols and that, they just didn't bother. They used to shoot prisoners.
But you were never had any really hazardous moments in operating over Southeast Asia?
Well, we got hit a few times, and I came back on the, on three engines on a Liberator and one and a half on a Blenheim and things like that, but that was about the worst.
How did you feel about these operations? Was there anything you... any particular target that you dreaded going in against?
Not really, no. No, it was, as I said before, you have a particular sort of mentality when you're that age. You don't sort of analyse things too deeply. It's all quite exciting, apart from the danger.
What do you think was the upper age limit which was suitable for such operations?
Well, we used to think they were getting on a bit at 30. Strange it may seem. I think by 30 then people have started to get a bit of sense and sense of proportion and analyse things.
So it was attitude rather than physical condition that determined the upper age limit?
I would think so. I would think, you know, as people get older they acquire more responsibilities and they sort of think more about planning and life ahead and so on. When you're young, tomorrow's a long way away, and the day after is eternity.
Did you have people of over 30?
Yes, we had Joe Moffat. He was an Australian squad leader. He became a flight commander on Blenheims and again on Liberators. And he, I think, was 32 or 33 in the early days on the Blenheims, and we used to think of him as granddad.
How did you personally stand up to the pressure of doing the work?
I never had any problems, I don't think, really. I don't recall ever feeling sort of particularly afraid or unwilling to do the work. I think I took a rather fatalistic view about things. But I can never recall any... I mean, some people, it became too much for them, and they just retired from flying. And I think in those days were marked LMF, lacking moral fibre.
Did you ever come across such cases?
Yes, I knew one chap who was taken off flying, but he came back onto flying and did very well, actually. He was a wireless operator.
Was he supposed to be an LMF case?
Yes, that was the reason that he was taken off flying, because he was frightened of it. But as I say, he came back again.
Did you notice anything about his behaviour?
Well, no. People don't sort of broadcast these things. There's a sort of general devil-may-care attitude about the whole thing. It was difficult to see below the surface.
Was that in India?
Yes, in India. Yes.
Which squadron was that with?
Well, at the Blenheims. I know that.
The 60 Squadron?
Yes, 60 Squadron, yes. I think that everything about the life on the squadron was a sort of a bit of a lark, a bit of a camping expedition, with the poor living quarters and the poor food and the poor conditions. It was all a bit sort of a safari type of existence.
What was the attitude of his comrades towards this LMF chap?
No loathing or anything like that, I don't think. I think there's probably, if anything, it was feeling sorry for the boat, that he couldn't handle it, really.
Were you personally praying for the end of the war?
Not really. Except when the European War finished and the Japanese War was still going on, I thought, oh, I might get out of this all right, after all. And just at the time that I finished this tour of operations with 99 Squadron, Qantas came round trying to recruit pilots to start a new civil air service from Ceylon to Australia. And I was interviewed and offered a job with them.
This was the autumn of 45.
Yes, this is the autumn. And I said, no, I've been away for so long that I wanted to go home. And so I turned that down. And then right away, the Air Force came up with an idea for experienced air crews from the East to come home to England and go around the airfields to pass on advice to the Tiger Force, the Air Force that were waiting to go out to the Far East, the Lancasters and everything. And that was really, the tour in India then was 3 years for a married man and 4 years for a single man, and I'd done about 3.5 years when this Tiger thing came up, and I was sent home on that, ostensibly. But of course, while I was on the way home, the Japanese War, I was on leave when I got home, and the Japanese War finished, so it didn't materialise. But the idea was to go round to the stations and pass on experience of flying in those conditions.
How did you greet the news of the end of the Japanese War and the dropping of the bombs?
I was quite relieved, really, because I felt that if they'd carried on by orthodox means, there were going to be a whole lot of people killed, because the Japanese were so fanatic, they wouldn't give in easily. And I had no qualms about that at all. Rather than 75,000 at Hiroshima than half a million Americans and Britons. No, I think the Japanese deserved all they got, and there was very little sympathy for them. They had been aggressive and hostile, and they hadn't lived by our standards anyway. They lived by their own standards, but we found them, quite bestial. Yes, I finished on 99 Squadron in June of 1945 and was then posted home to take part in a scheme known as Operation Tiger, the idea of which was to go around to the stations in England and give advice to the heavy bomber crews on flying conditions in the Far East. But I went on leave, and while I was on leave, the Japanese war finished, and so the Tiger scheme never came into operation. When I got back to England, I came back by boat, incidentally. It took a month. Most of my contemporaries were sent on indefinite leave to await demobilisation. But I was posted down to Lulsgate Bottom near Bristol to do an instructor's course on Oxfords, which I'd never flown. And when I'd done that, and I was sent on an instructor's course on Lancasters, which I'd never flown. And when I'd done that, I was posted to Swindley as a night flying instructor, and I spent the last 2 months of my service life instructing people on flying four-engined aircraft at night, which I think was the most hazardous part of my war service. And in March 46 I was demobilised and went back to my old job.